ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Srila Prabhupada writes in the preface, in his preface to the Srimad Bhagavatam, that if one reads the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, including the Sanskrit verse, the word-for-word translations, the verse translations and the purports, then he is certain to be a God-realized person by after reaching the end of the ninth canto. So reading these word-for-word translations is not just a translation, but Srila Prabhupada explicates, also brings out more meaning. The literal translation of Ishvara Alambanam, for instance, is that Alambanam means support, so having Ishvara, the Supreme Controller, as his support. So Srila Prabhupada translates this as completely taking shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, accepting Krishna is my support, is my shelter. Then again, Ananya Radhasaha, for Rantidev, this refers to Rantidev. Radhasa, what does this mean? Yeah. There's a famous name derived from this verb. What's that name? Radha. What's the verse in which that's she's alluded to? Anaya radhito nunam bhagavan ishvaro harihi. Sometimes people say that Radha is not referred to in the Bhagavatam, but she is, but not directly by name. There's one example. In other places also, she's indicated. Those who know the secret, they know who's being talked about. So here, Ananya Radha Saha means Rantidev who worshipped exclusively Krishna. Ananya, no other. And Srila Prabhupada, again, in the word-for-word translation, explicates this by saying, for Rantidev, who was undeviating and desired nothing other than to serve the Supreme Lord. So that's the meaning of Aradhana. It generally means worship. But the real meaning of worship is the service attitude. Otherwise, formal worship is not really aradhana. So that's a big topic in itself. The service attitude has to be there. Just like at the beginning of Bhagavatam, yesterday evening, I was discussing that word in the second verse, which comes again and again in the Bhagavatam. Susru shibihi means those who have an attitude of faithful service. Service attitude. We want to serve with faith. The two concepts are combined in one word. Susru shibihi. Susru shaka means a servant. Alright, so the verse translates. Actually, this any word in Prabhupada's books, and you can make a whole book out of it. There's so much. It's all interlinked and people are studying so many useless things. Study the Bhagavatam. Susru shibihi, with the proper attitude. And life is successful simply by that. It's not that one's life becomes successful by studying the Bhagavatam. One's life is successful by studying the Bhagavatam. That is success in itself. Anyway, translation. O Maharaj Parikshit, because King Rantidev was a pure devotee, always Krishna conscious, and free from all material desires, the Lord's illusory energy, Maya, could not exhibit herself before him. On the contrary, for him, Maya entirely vanished exactly like a dream. Purport, as it is said, Krishna Surja Shama Maya Hoy Andhaka Jahan Krishna Tahan Nahi Maya Adhika. Just as there is no chance that darkness can exist in the sunshine, In a pure Krishna conscious person, there can be no existence of Maya. The Lord Himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Devi yesha gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mam eva ye prapadyante mayam etang tarantite. This divine energy of mind consisting of the three modes of material nature is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Unquote. If one wants to be free from the influence of Maya, the illusory energy, one must become Krishna conscious and always keep Krishna prominent within the core of his heart. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord advises that one always think of him. Manmana bhava madbhakto madhyaji mang namaskaru. In this way, by always being Krishna-minded or Krishna-conscious, one can surpass the influence of Maya, Mayam etang tarantite. Because Rantidev was Krishna-conscious, he was not under the influence of the illusory energy. The word Swapnavat is significant in this connection, because in the material world, the mind is absorbed in materialistic activities. When one is asleep, many contradictory activities appear in one's dreams. When one awakens, however, these activities automatically merge into the mind. Similarly, as long as one is under the influence of the material energy, he makes many plans and schemes, but when one is Krishna conscious, such dreamlike plans automatically disappear. Ishvara lambanam chittankur vatonanya radhasaha maya gunamayi rajan swapnavat pratyaliyata. O Maharaj Parikshit, because King Rantidev was a pure devotee, always Krishna conscious and free from all material desires, the Lord's illusory energy Maya could not exhibit herself before him. On the contrary, for him Maya entirely vanished, exactly like a dream. In the verse that's under discussion today, two words appear. Maya gunamayi, which also appear, that's a noun with an adjective. Gunamayi modifies or not modifies, but explains what is the nature of Maya. Or it's that Maya which is gunamayi. Here guna is understood to mean the three modes of material nature. So these words also appear in the well-known verse of Bhagavad Gita, which Lord Krishna quotes, which Srila Prabhupada quotes in the purport. Daivi yesha gunamayi mama maya durateya. So in this well-known verse, it continues, mam eva ye prapadyante maya metam tarantite. This Maya is very difficult to go out of, to overcome. But one who surrenders to me, Krishna says, crosses beyond it, or can easily cross beyond it. That's, again, Srila Prabhupada adds some explanatory words in the translation. So this principle, which is described in Bhagavad Gita, two principles, one of Maya being very difficult to overcome, but easy to overcome for those who surrender to Krishna, is practically explained in the verse under discussion today, how King Rantidev easily crossed over Maya by taking shelter of Krishna. So in this way we find in Bhagavad Gita all the principles that are described therein are described in more detail with the examples of devotees and examples of the Supreme Lord. Bhagavatam means the narration of the Supreme Lord and his devotees. So how these principles, they're not simply some theoretical ideas, but it actually works. If Lord Krishna tells Arjuna, you surrender to me, or he implies that, if anyone surrenders to me, then they can easily cross this otherwise insurmountable influence of illusion. And Maharaj Ambarish was able to do that. He did that. In many ways, he might seem an unlikely candidate for being Krishna conscious. We have in the Bhagavatam the histories of many kings who were Krishna conscious. But kings, in general, you wouldn't expect them to be Krishna conscious because they're great enjoyers and controllers of the material world. It must be difficult to be Krishna conscious if you're respected as good as the Supreme Lord. The king is respected as the representative of the Supreme Lord. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that among men he is the monarch. Who knows that line from Bhagavad Gita? I heard you're giving lots of shlokas instructions. Anyone? Naranam Chandaradhipam. Among men, Lord Krishna says, I am the king. So in Vedic culture, the king was highly respected and loved. It's not like the modern prime minister who gets voted in or sometimes takes over without getting voted in and gets thrown out shortly thereafter. And one of the perks of being the prime minister is that every day a cartoon lampooning you appears in the newspapers. The cartoonist expertly emphasizing all the unusual features of the... If someone has a bumpy nose or an over-fat body, they'll exaggerate it to make the figure, the subject of lampooning, look even more stupid than he actually is. But in Vedic culture, that was absolutely unthinkable. The kings were respected and respectable. In our generation, all you young fellows down there, now I'm talking like an old man, we often used to hear the older generation lamenting that, oh, these youngsters nowadays, they don't respect their parents. They don't respect their teachers. Well, there's a good reason for that, is that the parents and the teachers did very little to warrant respect. So naturally they weren't respected. Of course, there was also propaganda not to respect anyone. It's also part of the package that comes along with democracy, is that we all treat everyone equally. Treat everyone like stool, and then it's all equal. We're all equal. Don't care for anyone. But the Vedic culture, these kings were very much respected and loved. Loved for their caring for the citizens, like a father being concerned with their welfare. Of course, this is students of Indian history, especially those who are coming from the Indology faculties of Western or Westernized universities, will say that this is an idealized description. It's idealized to the point of being almost fiction, because many of the kings were not at all like that. Some of them were very despotic. Although even up to recent times, some of the kings were loved. That Gayatri Devi in Jaipur, she's from Kuch Bihar, but she married the Raja of Jaipur, and then he died, and then they had independence of India, and she stood as a candidate, and everyone voted for her. Everyone in the whole of Jaipur. There was no competition. They all loved her, actually. So the ideal Vedic king was loved by his citizens. So anyway, the point here is that it might be very difficult for such a person to be Krishna conscious. If he's wealthy, all the kingdom is supposed to be his property. He's wealthy, famous, all his needs and more than needs taken care of. The king will be woken up in the morning by people. He has his own private concert going on just to wake him up, to gently wake him up. And then all kinds of servants. And in previous times, there was rich people, they needed more servants than needed today, because nowadays even rich people, they turn the tap on for themselves. But previously, there weren't taps, and to get water, they'd have to bring it from a river or pond, and so there was a whole caste of water bearers. Their job was to bring water for the citizens in a town. You'll find in the description of the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Ramayanandai, their service was carrying water for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That was it. That was their service, because if you have to go up and down a few times a day, and then big pots would be filled up, and these would be different ones would be used for cooking and for bathing and so many things. So that was their service, carrying water. So the kings had lots of servants for all kinds of things. Not just for their needs, but for their sense gratification. We read when Devaki went, she was presented to Vasudeva, then along with her went so many maidservants, who also doubled up. The maidservants who went with the queen, they doubled up as sexual partners for the king. As Srila Prabhupada explained, the kings were generally, they ate very good food, and they were very strong bodied, and they were very much influenced by Rajogun, so they'd have strong sexual appetite also, and that was considered good for a king, because it's not good for a king to be, if he's going to rule over the people, he can't be a wimp, so to say. He has to be someone with plenty of gusto, plenty of energy and ambition to take charge. That's one of the qualities of a king mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, Ishvara Bhava. Elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna condemns Ishvara Bhava as a quality of the demoniac. Ishvaraham Maham Bhogi, to consider I am the controller and I am the enjoyer, is the prime symptom of demoniac people. But it's listed in one of the qualities of the Kshatriya, Ishvara Bhava. It means someone who takes charge. And we'll find that everywhere, or in most places in human society, there's always someone who he naturally takes charge. When everyone else is wondering what to do, and he says, okay, do this. Naturally people follow him, because he has that bhava, that mood of taking charge. So Rantidev was a king, and no doubt he had all these qualities. But instead of being deluded by this maya gunamai, this threefold, three ropes of maya. Gunamai is compared to, guna means quality, guna means the satagun, rajagun, tamagun, it's called the three qualities of material nature, although in English there's no real word for that. Srila Prabhupada translates it as three qualities, although there's no equivalent in English, because there's no concept of that in the English language. So another meaning for the word guna is rope. So three strings, when they become intertwined, You make a very strong rope. So very difficult to get out of if one is tied up by that. But Ranti Dev was not tied up by Maya. Even though a king is expected to be in Rajaguna or influenced by that, not wholly influenced by that. He's also influenced by the Brahmanas and he studies the Vedic literature also. So the influence of Saktagun is also there. But for Ranti Dev, his kingdom and everything that went along with it, which would be quite fascinating to anyone else, to him it appeared he wasn't interested. It was just like a dream to him. Even nowadays people go to visit museums, don't we know, in London. It's one of the tourist attractions. People go to look at the opulence, all the various, the clothes and the jewelry and the art that was, that the kings had. The clothes they wore were so opulent and the jewelry they wore was so opulent. And the food they ate, and even they'd eat on gold plates and 100 pounds fine. Should make £100 fine for anyone whose cell phone goes off. Please turn it off or take it out.
Sorry.
So the kings there, they were so opulent, and people who even see that nowadays, they say, look at that. Oh, look at that. Look at that sword. You'll find the swords. They weren't just functionally built, but they were inlaid with jewels and very aesthetically made. When the guns and pistols they came to India, then they also made them very aesthetically. You can see at Jaipur Museum, there are so many things like that. So people even nowadays they pay to go and see all these things. They look so attractive. Things aren't made like that nowadays. Nowadays everything's simply functional. There's some plastic mold and they make a chair and the chair comes out and there's no finesse. There's no idea that we should try to make it pleasing in any way. It's just functional, that's all. So they lived amidst opulence that would attract the mind and bewilder anyone else. Actually, the kings, they were trained from a young age in Gurukul. So they had good character. Otherwise, it can be very bewildering. Power, as we know, bewilders. But Ranti Dev was not only not bewildered, but he had no interest in this. It was just like a dream. It didn't appear real to him because he was connected with the actual reality, who is Krishna. That's the point. The point is that Ranti Dev was completely absorbed in Krishna. Ishvara lambanam chittam. His consciousness was completely absorbed in Krishna. Kulashekhar Alva, who composed the Mukundamala, which was a very famous text even today among Sri Vaishnavas, especially in South India. And Srila Prabhupada is also very fond of that. He used to sing shlokas like that. So it's described about him that he was so Krishna conscious that his ministers, if they thought it was a problem, because he wasn't administering the state properly, he was just absorbed in Krishna consciousness, became very difficult for the ministers to advise him, because he was what to them appeared to be like in a dreamlike state, but he apparently had no contact with this world, or he contacted this world, but he saw everything in terms of Krishna consciousness. So when he was listening to the recitation of Ramayana one time, he was hearing it and how all the armies of the monkeys are being called together to go and attack Lanka. And in the middle he called out, "Okay, call the army, we're going to go and join Ram, go and attack Lanka." And he got all the armies, and the ministers had to try and convince him that actually that Leela already took place and it's over. They were trying to, he was living it. So for him, there was the Ram Leela and the present day, he couldn't distinguish them due to his absorption in pure love of Krishna. So Ranti Dev, he was an example of that. And this is practically proved by how when he was tested by, was it Indra and Agni, was it? Who was the other who tested him? Indra, the two demigods. Sorry. Yeah, all right. Oh, that's described later on. And he was willing to give his whole body to fulfill his promise and relieve the suffering of the hunger of the hunter, who was actually Indra, wasn't it? I don't remember. So that seems like a great sacrifice, but for a pure devotee, he sees everything in, not just in terms of Krishna consciousness in a philosophical way, but actually experiences how reality is Krishna. We discuss it, and the pure devotees experience it, how reality is Krishna. And therefore, for them, the body, they just see it as some kind of vehicle that they're in for a short time to serve the Lord. They can go to any other one, just like you may be in a bus, and then you have to change buses, and you go from one bus to another, and you don't think a big thing, "Oh, I left that bus. Shh, such a great bus," but you just change buses, that's all. So for a pure devotee, changing bodies, or if the bus breaks down, it might be an inconvenience, but you don't get too much disturbed. But if a pure devotee just experiences that, that's described in the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita. No, well, maybe it's Harishwari Prabhu's diary. No, in Lilamrita. How at one point Srila Prabhupada, he had a severe toothache and his whole jaw was swollen, but he refused to go to a dentist. He said, I'm used to difficulties, and just went on with life. Who's had a toothache? Everyone's had toothache, right? It's those ones that they have, like the abscess, what's it called then? Some tunnel, something. Root canal. It's painful, isn't it? I had one once. I thought I'd just tolerate it. I didn't sleep for 2 nights. I couldn't sleep. 2 days or nights. And then I thought, I better go see a dentist. So, it's extremely painful. The problem just... eventually it fell out. That tooth is still with Harishwari Prabhu. There was a rule. Harishwari Prabhu, when he was inducted as Srila Prabhupada's servant, there's a rule. You don't ask anything from Prabhupada. If you need anything, get it from the local temple president, or go without it, or whatever. Don't ask anything. But then, when the tooth fell out, Harishwari Prabhu noticed that the swelling had gone down. So he was thinking, Well, if that tooth falls out, maybe I could get it. He confided. So then he asked, when it fell out, he thought that, he asked Prabhupada, "Oh, Srila Prabhupada, your tooth fell out." And Prabhupada pulled open his drawer and showed it. He said, "Yes." He put it in his drawer. And then Hari Shraibaru quickly calculated, "It's going to go in the drawer, and probably someone's going to throw it out. No one knows. I'm not supposed to ask anything from Prabhupada," but he thought, "I'll do it this one time." He said, "Prabhupada, could I have that tooth?" Prabhupada said, "Yes." Open the drawer, gave it to him. And he still has it and is worshipping it. So, and you can see the big, it's like the tooth shape in it, it's like half of it is all worn away. So where are we going? Deho smriti nahi ja sangsha bandhan kahata. Yes. Narottam Das Thakur says, for one who's not conscious of his body, then where's the question of being bound in material life? There's no question. If one is so much absorbed in Krishna consciousness that he doesn't even notice his body, then where is the question of being bound in this material world? Because being bound in this material world means bodily consciousness. So Ranti Dev was not in bodily consciousness. We talk about this. We discuss it regularly. There's a need to discuss it regularly. But it's a lot easier to talk about it than to actually be free from bodily consciousness. Anyone like to contest that? Even we talk about it for years. But it's not easy to get free from that bodily consciousness. Mayare koriya joy charan na jai, Narottam Das says too. We're attempting to conquer over Maya, but doesn't happen. We don't let go, or she doesn't let go. So that's possible by the mercy of devotees. Otherwise it's not possible. These elevated states of Krishna consciousness that we read about, hear about, it's possible. Possible. We have to have that hope, that faith. It's the only thing worth endeavoring for. There's nothing worth endeavoring for in this world. Obviously, should be obvious, although everyone in the world is pursuing the pot at the end of the rainbow. They're trying for something which doesn't exist, happiness in this material world. The whole history of the world is the futile and in every case failed attempt of persons to enjoy sense gratification. No one was successful yet in enjoying this material world. Big shots, little shots, no one was successful. So the only thing worth endeavoring for is tasaiva hi to prayate tako vido na labhyate yat brahmatam upriyadha. One should endeavor for that which is not, a person who's intelligent should endeavor for that which is not available anywhere in this world, and that's Krishna consciousness, which is beyond this world. So we have to maintain that hope, have that faith that if we continue with this process, then by the grace of Hari Guru Vaishnava, we can also attain to that level. And actually we've seen in the short time since Srila Prabhupada came to this world and introduced Krishna consciousness in the Western countries, that many unlikely candidates, significantly more unlikely than Ranti Dev, many unlikely candidates for pure devotional service have become delivered back to Godhead. The way they left their bodies indicates that they were Krishna conscious. Many devotees left this world in Vrindavan, or not in Vrindavan, but in the association of devotees who are chanting, and they themselves. We often see that devotees are in the last few weeks or days, it's like they go through a speeded up course in Krishna consciousness. It's like when they maybe going along at some rate or other in Krishna consciousness, and then when the inevitability of death just ahead of me comes up, then they get so many realizations and their spiritual desires crystallize, and they go back, for all indications, they go back to Godhead. So it is possible. As Srila Prabhupada once said, I heard this, that devotee asked Prabhupada that, well, will we actually go back to Godhead? And Prabhupada said that, well, we're making so much endeavor and dedicating our lives to give others the chance to go back to Godhead, so will we not also go? We're dispatching so many people, and then we ourselves will get left behind. So there's great hope. If we just stick on this path, that by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and all the devotees, we can attain this state which at present seems beyond us, but by Krishna's grace, he can make the impossible possible. Mameva ye prapadyante mayam etam tarantite. One who surrenders to me can easily cross beyond maya. So, Hare Krishna. Are there any questions about this? Please. Please ask now. If anyone wants to make any comment? Yes.
You mentioned that maya's, or we've got hold of maya, or maya has hold of us.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
Which one is it? Well, there's that well-known story. At least it's well-known to me because I tell it so many times. It's such an apt story from the Mahabharata of the king in his court. In those days, the entertainment was not the Olympic Games, but they'd have pundits, they're ministers. I mean, the ministers means they're Brahmins, so they weren't just worldly, they weren't just advising in worldly matters, but they were trained in philosophical understanding, and so they would have, the kings would have ministers, and they'd be surrounded by brahmanas, which helped to, ameliorate their tendency to just like dominate and bully others, surrounded by very purified people. So they would have discussions, philosophical discussions. So one king, he asked all his ministers one time, that why is it that we don't give up maya? That was the question. And then all the different Brahmins gave their opinion. And there was one old Brahmin who was considered the most wise, and he hadn't said anything yet. And they all looked at him. Oh, well, what do you say? What's your opinion? Maybe he was expected to speak last to give the final word, so to speak. So he was sitting there, and all of a sudden he got up and grabbed a pillar, just like that pillar, held onto it very tightly. He said, "Let me go! Let me go! Let me go! Let me go! Please, let me go!" And I thought, oh, what happened? He went senile? What happened to him? So after doing this drama for some time, he changed to his normal countenance and said that, well, this is why maya doesn't let us go. We're holding on and saying, let me go. So that's why I said, we don't let go of maya. But then I thought of that story, and then I thought that maya doesn't let us go because we're holding on and saying, let me go. If we really want to let go, then we let go. But again, it's understood that we've had these contaminations for many lifetimes, and it's difficult to change the habit, but it's possible by the mercy of Hari Guru, especially that by the mercy of devotees. It's stated. Yes, please.
Thank you for your class, Maharaj. It's very inspiring.
Well, thank you for all being here. You're all very inspiring. Really. It's easy just to, trade flatteries and That's what they do at the Rotary Club. It's set up. So I know, I've been in India, we often go to it's set up, it's Rotary, and they go around, and the one first person praises the next one, and he praises the next one, and they come round. I guess that's why it's called a Rotary Club. And they all praise each other. And then they open a bus shelter or something trivial, and then they make a big thing out of it. I sacrificed so much money after exploiting the people and making lots of money. Between 30 of them, they build a bus shelter. And great work of the Rotary Club. So this mutual flattery, you're very inspiring to be here and making so many sacrifices to live in this actually horrible place, which Srila Prabhupada certified as hell, and preach Krishna consciousness. So thank you very much. All glories to Radha Landinishwara. Approximately 1976 in Berry Place, the famous Berry Place, Adhikata Prabhu, one of the stalwarts of the Berry Place. So in that underground prasadam hall, I was there once with Patitu Dharan, who is out there in California. So he said to me, he was very senior devotee, I was very junior at that time. Now by default, I'm senior. So he said, why is this temple so wonderful? He said, it's all because of the temple president. And the temple president was Vichya Chavira Prabhu, who's no doubt a very wonderful devotee. And he said, and the temple president is Radha Landanishwara. So the temple president, who just walked in, is a wonderful devotee because he realizes he's the servant of Radha Landanishwara. That's the, just like the king is the king is good if he realizes that I'm the servant of the Supreme Lord, and therefore the servant of all the people. Anyway, what was your question? Say it quickly, otherwise I might start off again.
You were giving attention to the various forms of civilized decorum within the Vedic courts of the kings.
There's
a very nice story, which isn't featured in all the Ramayans, but in one translation I saw this, which exemplifies a little bit what you're talking about. And I'll try to.
Can everyone hear?
Okay. I'll try to tell it quickly.
Yes, no?
Not make a mess of it.
Okay.
But there's a famous story about the dog.
Yeah, in Uttara Ramayana.
Would you mind telling that?
In Uttara Ramayana, which isn't accepted, for instance, by the Sri Vaishnavas. Shall I tell the story?
Yes.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to remember it. There was a sadhu walking on the road, and there was a dog lying in the roadway. And the sadhu wanted the dog to get out of the way, and he didn't jump out of the way quick enough, so the sadhu beat him. And the dog went to see Lord Ram, because this was within the jurisdiction of Ayodhya, while Ram Bhagavan was ruling there. So Ram Bhagavan had a rule in his court that it was open, anyone can bring any complaint at any time. And of course, no one ever came. There was no complaint. But one time the dog came with a complaint. The dog was speaking. It was a very special dog. Well, there were special monkeys also. Right? They were speaking also. So he had a complaint that this sadhu beat me. So sadhu was called, and Ram Bhagavan said, yes, it's wrong, he shouldn't have beaten you, dog lying in the road. And of course, the dog should have got out of the way, but the sadhu, if he didn't get out of the way quick enough or whatever, the sadhu shouldn't have cruelly beaten him. So then Ram asked the dog, well, what do you think should be the punishment? And the dog said, well, put him in charge of this big famous mutt or monastery with so many monks, and or I guess they'd be brahmacharis or sannyasis, lots of opulence and wealth. And Ram said, well, that doesn't sound like a punishment. It sounds like a reward. He said, no, it's a punishment, because with such a nature as he's got, when he's put in charge, he'll offend all the sadhus, and then he'll get such a bad result. There's a really heavy punishment. And he said, I know, because I was in a similar situation in my previous life, and that's how I ended up as a dog. So that's the story. In brief.
One of the reasons I wanted to bring that up, Maharaj, if I may interject, is kind of a comment related to something you said in the beginning of the class about how Indologists and the faculties of scholars at various universities tend to look very pejoratively on the history of India.
Yeah.
And it's all bogus, mostly.
Tend to, I mean, they have, it's not just tend to, but there was a program, it was set up deliberately for that purpose, yeah. In the 19th century. The study called Indology was started with the purpose of undermining Vedic culture.
And it's still very much in place.
Still very prominent.
Invasion, bogus idea.
Well, that's been refuted so many times that it's
still popular.
Probably with the next generation will go out. You know, as you know, theories don't die; the professors die, and then yeah, the professors, because everyone believes in what they were trained in, and therefore they still believe it even if it's disproved. And then when they die out, the next generation comes in, and then the next theory takes over. But actually there's a huge amount of work to be done in writing books and making research on many, many topics. I had an idea. I won't do it in this lifetime because I don't have time. But there are others who can do it. I can give some direction. We need to write a religious history of India, beginning from Mahavishnu, breathing out, and then and just write it according to the scriptural way, and then we can talk about the different yugas, and then the Varnashram system, and then in the modern age, the Kali Yuga, how the different Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, influence of Islam, right up to the modern age, with all your bogus gurus and everything, and how the influence of certain persons from Bengal. There's been all these bogus gurus in modern India. It's very much an effect of this Jatamat Tatopat, which completely undermined the whole Vedic culture, which is based on following the Shastra. But Jatamat Tatopat just anything goes. It's hippie philosophy, actually. So it's encyclopedia work is required. Want to do it? You're interested?
Yeah, absolutely.
A few words of yours there makes you sound like an intellectual.
Right now.
What's that?
It's interesting that you should mention it because it's something I'm working on right now.
We'll talk about that, yeah.
But there's related also to
But
that.
It needs to be done in a very elaborate way so it can be very authoritative. And then that should set the trend for future generations. We need to write many books which will be so well presented that they'll become the standard seminal works.
Textbooks for you.
Yeah. And we should have our own, you know, set up our own educational system and we don't need to kowtow to the mundane educational system. Have our own educational system. And if our scholarship's good, they'll have to take these people will have to take note of it. That was there in the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. His disciples, himself and his disciples, they were writing in such a line, they no holds barred, you know. They were just really heavy on all kinds of bogus things, and just straight out. They didn't, not using any euphemisms, they mentioned names, but their presentation was so scholarly, and not just like using big words but presenting facts and analysis, that it was respected. And scholars scholarly people, even scholarly people who were blasted in the pages of their Gaudiya magazine, one of them wrote in and said, well, actually, your presentation was very, I appreciate your presentation. It was so well presented that, you know, he appreciated it. So, it's not just a matter of using pejoratives, but actually pointing out where there was one Gauranga Nagari, the editor of the of a Gaura Nagari magazine came to see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and then he wrote in his magazine in the next edition that even though we have differences of opinion, still I Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati has done great work for Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and it was my great fortune to have his darshan, even though Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati cut him up. But then in response to that, instead of in the Gaudiya magazine writing that, yes, well, very nice, Haridas Goswami is very good, they brought out a 5-part series of articles showing everything wrong with the Gauranagari band. That was their response. They were unrelenting. They wanted to establish the truth. But they did so in a manner that everyone had to respect. Because it wasn't simply calling names or dogmatic, but it was fully researched. So this kind of scholarship is required. It's fully committed and fully scholarly and on our own terms. That's the important thing. If we go to the mundane universities, we can't speak on our own terms. We're immediately compromised. Yes.
That's so inspiring to hear you speak like that, Maharaj, because
don't we know? Because, yeah.
There's a really refreshing body of research coming out by young scholars in Indology showing that before the time of Alexander, which is the kind of pivotal point where the Western world starts congratulating itself, that democracy started emerging and with the advent of, you know, more atheistic cultures and that shying away from theocracies, we started to develop this idea that we are, you know, that people
democracy is intrinsically better. If there's anyone who doesn't agree with that, we'll bomb them into becoming democratic.
Exactly. Pax Americana. But they're showing that there were republics all across northern, central, and southern India where they would send representatives of the villages to speak in the courts, which is bigger, it's closer to what we have as we call democracy today. It's all republicanism. But they had a much better system in India long before Alexander. And it's blowing the sort of bogus lids off of a lot of people's notions about early Indian democracy.
Good. Who's doing that? That tantric guy, what's his name? Frawley. He's done something on that.
He's one of a group of young researchers.
He's young?
Well, no, he's not
so young now.
He's got a young attitude towards revising.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of work, although he's a Shakta tantric.
He's almost an atheist.
Is it? Yeah. A lot of Hindus are.
Yeah.
Hindu scholars. They'll promote Hinduism, but they're actually atheists, like this Narendra Modi in Gujarat. He's also an atheist. Also this Bal Thakur. He's also an atheist.
He's also an atheist.
They're flying the Hindutva flag, but if you speak with them, they'll say, I don't believe in God. It's crazy, isn't it? Anyway, Hare Krishna. I think we should finish. Hare Krishna. Enough for now, before we get too political. I have to apply for my Indian visa today.